I'm delighted to introduce Professor Mark Steinberg. Professor Steinberg is Rupert and Lillian Radford Professor of Law at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas. He's the director of the SMU Corporate Directors Institute, amongst many other responsibilities. Hello. Which one? 3CL seminar. Sorry. Prior to becoming the Radford Professor at SMU, Professor Steinberg taught at a variety of places: University of Maryland School of Law, Wharton School for the University of Pennsylvania, the National Law Center of George Washington University, and also Georgetown University Law Center. Amongst other things, he's been used as an expert witness in a number of significant cases, notably including Enron, one of the biggest corporate scandals of our times. And in a past life, Professor Steinberg was an enforcement attorney at the US Securities and Exchange Commission, and he was also a special projects counsel there, where he directly assisted the SEC's general counsel in various projects and cases, and also served as the general counsel's confidential legal advisor. So as well as being an esteemed academic in the field, Professor Steinberg has also very much been at the coalface of corporate and securities law enforcement in his former roles. So without further ado, I'll hand over to Professor Steinberg for his talk today, which is on expanding the liability of corporate counsel in the United States. And just before you speak, because we are in a more informal setting, I think we can be slightly looser with our time. So if you want to take a bit longer, feel free. Okay. So, Professor Steinberg.
Well, thank you. Thanks for inviting me. Thanks for arranging this, Professor Moore. I'd like to thank Professor Benavidnisti for helping to arrange this, and of course, Dr. Gamiloff for arranging my visit. If any of you have any questions or comments while I'm speaking, please let me know. I teach at SMU in Dallas, a major university, and from an international law perspective, I would think that all of you are familiar with the international lawyer, which is perhaps the highest circulated periodical in international law in the world. It's published by the section of international law with SMU. I'm the editor-in-chief of the international lawyer. We're about to have our volume 50, number one, so we're arranging that issue, but we're always looking for good articles. So if you would like to publish with the International Lawyer, you know, please consider the publication. Be delighted to receive an article from you. The issue of attorney liability in the United States, I think, is far different than, for example, in the United Kingdom. I imagine practically any country in the world. Lawyers are deep pockets in the United States, especially the corporate securities law setting. They are sued with frequency, and in fact, if one were to obtain a liability insurance policy in the United States, which lawyers must have, there is a securities law exclusion that the insurer, such as Lloyd's of London, would not cover securities law malpractice unless the lawyer were to purchase a rider, pay additional coverage in order to have that coverage, simply because the extent to which lawyers have been sued. For example, the last case that I've been involved in that's publicly known is a case involving a private investment in the state of Arizona where investors lost $900 million. Two major law firms were sued, Greenberg Traurig, which has offices, I believe, all over the world, must have 1,000 lawyers, and Quarles & Brady, which is another law firm that has hundreds of lawyers. And I was retained by the trustee to testify against the law firms. And this is public information, and the law firm settled the litigation before trial for $88 million. Just to give you an idea of the type of liability exposure that is being paid in the United States. That case involved private offerings. There was no publicly held company, so they're not registered offerings with the SEC. These were private offerings, and and investors alleged this was a settlement. So, of course, the law firm neither admitted nor denied the allegations. That the law firm drafted disclosures in the offering documents and knowing that those disclosures were untruthful, or having reason to believe that they were untruthful. And in that case, there were a number of issues that were not disclosed, and the law firm settled the litigation without admitting liability for $88 million.
So that was all covered by the insurers?
With that, I don't know. Mm. I mean, that's between the law firms and their insurer. But that would be significant liability, of course, coverage for the law firms not to go out of pocket at all. But there is not the situation here where necessarily all the coverages are embraced by insurance coverage. Sometimes the law firms have to go into their own pockets to pay for the liability coverage. Another interesting matter that I had was, you mentioned Enron. A lot of individuals think that Enron caused the end of Arthur Andersen. And yes, it played a part, but approximately 6 months to a year before that, Arthur Andersen was sued in a case brought by the Baptist Foundation of Arizona, which involved a multi-hundred million dollar, if not billion dollar, loss for investors. And Arthur Andersen was sued by on behalf of plaintiffs in that situation. And I was hired by Arthur Andersen in that case to testify against the law firm in the offering as well. And the law firm ended up settling for approximately $20 million. Again, a matter of public information. Arthur Andersen ended up settling for over $200 million, just to show the amount of damages exposure that are implicated, exposures that are implicated in the United States. So that lawyers are not viewed in the same exact context as auditors, because auditors clearly owe their obligation to the investing public. But lawyers still are viewed as a passkey, as the red or green light to the consummation of securities transactions in the United States, far more than I think in other countries. I've read some in the UK where it's rather difficult to hold lawyers liable here in the UK with respect to financial debacles. And this started with the SEC way back in the 1960s, 1970s, when the SEC took the position, the Securities and Exchange Commission took the position that the lawyers really are the passkey and access person with respect to the integrity and accuracy of disclosure, and that attorneys must have the wherewithal to refuse to provide services to a non-compliant client. The key case that focused on this was the Carter Johnson case in 1981. In that case, what you had were two partners of a Wall Street law firm. And there was deficient disclosure where material financial information was not adequately disclosed to the investing public. The company, National Telephone was the name of the company, went into insolvency. And the SEC Enforcement Division brought an enforcement action against these attorneys. And you can only imagine if this were brought today against Wall Street lawyers, let alone 35 years ago. 1981 seems far more recent than 35 years ago, but it is 35 years ago. It seems like a long time for those of you who are very young in this room, but for those of us who are a bit older, 1981 doesn't seem that 35 years ago. Am I correct in that?
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it seems like it was maybe 15 years ago. Maybe. And I was at the SEC at the time. And this was really quite a proceeding as far as just the political nature of it, that a regulatory agency would bring an enforcement action against Wall Street lawyers.
Was this a 10b-5?
No, this was. Thank you for asking. That because I wouldn't have clarified, I wouldn't have thought about clarifying this without the question. Thank you. The SEC has a disciplinary rule called Rule 102E, which at that time was called Rule 2, paren small e, which is a rule dealing with professional conduct. And it generally was focused against accountants and to a lesser degree with respect to attorneys. And it was generally used with respect to attorneys attorneys with smaller firms engaged in clear illegality. And what that rule permits is the commission to bar an attorney or suspend an attorney or an accountant for unprofessional conduct. And unprofessional conduct would be aiding and abetting a securities law violation, or very broadly under the rule, engaging in unprofessional conduct. And this gives the commission literally the authority to bar or suspend before the SEC. Now, one may think that, suspending or barring, that means if you have a client that has a case before the SEC, then the attorney cannot represent that person in the litigated proceeding. Well, the rule goes further, much further than that. Representing a client means that if there's any SEC filing whatsoever, and the attorney is representing the client in that matter, the attorney cannot do so. The attorney is barred. So, example, if there is a 10Q or a 10Q or a 10K, a quarterly filing with the SEC or an annual filing with the SEC, and the attorney were the attorney representing the enterprise, the attorney would be barred from representing the client. So even with respect to transactional lawyers, the rule is extremely broad. And the SEC, to a great degree, has backed off using it. They've engaged in a lot of jawboning, which, generally a lot of talking about it. As some of you are following the criminal prosecution in the United States, you've seen a lot of talk by the prosecutors, but yet with respect to the financial crisis, there has not been one criminal indictment against a leading figure, insider, with respect to the financial crisis. The biggest official that the SEC has gone after, I believe, is one case dealing with Angelo Morvillo, who was the chief executive officer of Countrywide, which was later merged with, was it Bank of America? Don't hold me to that, but a larger bank. And the SEC brought an enforcement action against Angelo Morvillo, which he subsequently settled without admitting or denying. But in any event, going back to the Carter-Johnson proceeding, this was a situation in which there were inaccurate disclosures made. The SEC Enforcement Division brought the case, and administrative law in the United States is criticized from the standpoint that you have an administrative agency like the Securities and Exchange Commission. It could be the Environmental Protection Agency. It could be the Federal Trade Commission. They're all part of the Administrative Procedure Act. And what happens under administrative enforcement is that the enforcement division of the agency, such as the SEC, would recommend to the commission itself that an enforcement action be brought. The agency would thereupon authorize the action. The agency would, the staff of the agency, the enforcement staff, would bring the enforcement action. If it were not settled, then it would go to adjudication before an administrative law judge, which is a separate body of judges that are appointed pursuant to the Administrative Procedure Act, so that the SEC enforcement staff would be trying the case before administrative law judges. In which the argument has been made that these judges have structural bias. In other words, they're more inclined to rule in favor of the enforcement division than they are in favor of the defendants. And in fact, statistics show that the last ones I've seen is that the SEC enforcement staff was successful in roughly 90% of the cases it brought, while before a federal judge in federal court, the commission was successful perhaps 50% of the time, if that. So there was a tremendous discrepancy.
So it sounds like from a defendant's point of view, you'd be crazy not to settle then?
I'll go ahead and continue. Yeah, sure. So So what goes on there is that there's the finding of if there's a finding of liability, then the defendant can appeal to the commission. So the argument is that here's the commission that authorized the action, now being the adjudicator to determine whether the case was meritorious. And then the defendant loses that case, the defendant may appeal to the U.S. Court of Appeals as a matter of right, and that's the independent adjudication. But the fact of the matter is that unless a person has a lot of financial resources and wherewithal, that it would it will take a lot of money and time. For example, I imagine that you've heard of Mark Cuban, mm-hmm. right? I don't know if many of you have or not, but Mr. Cuban is the owner of the Dallas Mavericks, outspoken critic of President-elect Trump, a billionaire by Claire standards, and the Mavericks are terrible this year. I think they've got 2 wins. So they have fallen 2 wins out of like 14 games, so they have fallen on very hard times. He was sued by the SEC for insider trading. Are you familiar with that case or heard of it or no? Or?
Maybe.
Okay, this was not administratively, this was before a federal court. The commission itself decides whether it's going to bring the case administratively or through the courts. It's not the defendant that decides, it's the commission itself. They brought this case before the courts, and Mr. Cuban, of course, has significant financial resources. I was his expert witness in the case. And he fought it all the way through trial and went up to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit after the district judge dismissed the claim. The Court of Appeals reversed the district court's determination and sent it back for trial. So trial was actually conducted and he was found not liable by the jury. My point here is that I understand that he spent somewhere around $7 to $8 million defending himself in the case. So most people don't have that kind of money. Now, of course, he had taking my role aside, he had the very finest lawyers in the country representing him, several law firms, several lawyers. I don't think he spared much expense getting the very best that he could get. So roughly 90%, give or take, of the SEC enforcement actions are settled, with the defendants neither admitting nor denying to the SEC's allegations. This is done from the defendant's point of view, from the standpoint of cost, because it's extremely expensive to litigate, from the standpoint of reputational damage, because the Wall Street Journal or New York Times, Washington Post will be reporting these cases. And for publicly held companies, it's not a good idea to be impugned. Even though there's no finding of liability, simply the allegations are damaging. And then for inside executives, they don't want to be faced with this anxiety. They don't want to be faced with time away from the business, and of course from the activist shareholders. They're not. This gives them a situation as well, and then the disclosure issues and so on. So there's a specialty in the U.S. with respect to law firms having specialties in SEC enforcement defense to represent a number of parties. From the SEC, and another reason that's settled is that there's a U.S. Supreme Court case called Park Lane Hosiery versus Shore that was decided around 1979, where the U.S. Supreme Court said that with respect to finding of adjudication in an SEC enforcement action, a private plaintiff can thereupon file a private lawsuit and use that to collaterally stop the defendant from relitigating the issues of adjudication. So, for example, if there's intent found, there's different elements in a private claim versus the SEC claim. For example, in a private claim, there must be reliance shown, there must be loss causation, there must be damages. The SEC does not have to prove those types of standards with respect to it bringing a case. But it must prove, for example, intent, that if it's a fraud claim, which is a Section 10B claim, or also called a Rule 10B5 claim, the SEC must prove intent. Well, if there's a finding of adjudication that there's intent, that's a huge stumbling block for the plaintiff to simply be able to invoke collateral estoppel. And now we're talking about millions of dollars or hundreds of millions of dollars of prospective damages. So that's another reason why there's settlement to prevent this type of of collateral estoppel. From the SEC standpoint is that although the SEC is a very active agency, and of course it has suffered reputational damage of its own for failing to uncover the Madoff or the Stanford debacles, their personnel is limited, like any other enforcement agency, and that permitting the commission to settle these cases enables the commission to move on to other cases. If the commission were settled in court litigating these cases, then of course it could bring far fewer cases. So the commission's perspective is that as long as it gets the relief it largely wants, then it, such as barring officers and directors, fines, undertakings, and the undertakings can be quite broad. For example, years ago, Occidental committed alleged disclosure violations, and with respect to its environmental issues, just to show how far the SEC goes into other areas of the law. And in that settlement, without Occidental admitting or denying, Occidental agreed to hire an environmental consultant that would advise the company with respect to environmental compliance, and then would have to disclose to the SEC basically the situation and what the findings were and what was being done to remedy them. And being in corporate governance, you'd be interested in this, is that the chief executive officer at that time was Armin Hammer of Occidental. And he had the strongest vehicle for a CEO I ever had, that I ever saw. And that is, when a director became a director of Occidental, he had a piece of paper for them to sign. And that was their letter of resignation, undated. So he had in his drawer that he had letters of resignation from directors and the board. And then when he became displeased with any of them, he would simply put a date on them and they would be off the board. And this was not disclosed to shareholders who were voting for these directors as director nominees.
Independent directors as well.
It was years ago, but yes, independent directors as well, yes. This case was brought around 1980, so we're going back a ways, but just to show how corporate governance has changed, sometimes we think things are moving very slowly, and at times they are, but compared to how things were or 35, 36 years ago, I mean, it's been a tremendous improvement. But I'm sure it's still today in the UK and certainly in the US, you still find directors who have structural bias, and you find directors who are basically beholden to the chief executive officer. And in the US, the matter of director salaries are increasing significantly. The Wall Street Journal reported that in the largest companies, these outside directors are making over $200,000 a year for serving on these corporate boards, which if one is not an independent multimillionaire, you know, that's a significant amount of salary for the amount of time per hour that one works for this type of salary. And also there are stock benefit plans and so on for the outside directors, and of course the prestige and so on. And I imagine some of you have looked at derivative litigation in the U.S. perhaps, and know the challenges in which plaintiffs have in order to bring a derivative litigation. You may recall there must be a demand in the board of directors. Most states adopt universal demand. There's the business judgment rule applied to the board's determination whether the litigation should go forward. So it's very challenging to bring a derivative suit in the U.S. In this type of situation. And that's why these direct actions are so much more favored, because there's none of these procedural requirements. Although when fraud is alleged in private litigation, especially on the federal level, fraud must be pled with particularity, very significant particularity under the federal securities laws, and there's no discovery that's afforded at this stage. So that means one must be able to plead fraud with particularity without being afforded any discovery to access information that would help plead that. So roughly half of the cases are dismissed at the pleading stage without any discovery being afforded. Now, of course, one would argue that the great equalizer in all this in the U.S. is, of course, the contingent fee structure, which permits plaintiff's lawyers to earn an enormous amount of money. For example, in the Enron case, Enron was a very successful action for investors. The lead investor, which may surprise some of you, was the University of California. They were a large institutional investor in Enron and lost, I believe it was $20 million. Don't hold me to that, roughly $20 million with their investment in Enron. And the recovery in that case was somewhere around $8 billion that the investors received through settlements, investment banks, accounting firms, law firms, other financial intermediaries. What were the attorney's fees in that case? Roughly $700 million. So significant fees generated from that litigation, of course, with a very tremendous recovery for the individual investors. The other aspect of the U.S. litigation, of course, is that there's no loser pays situation. Unless the litigation is brought frivolously, so long as non-frivolous motions, actions are undertaken, each side bears its own costs, which is another incentive, of course, as well as the class action vehicle, which enables the massing of these claims on both the federal and state level. Well, what happened in 1998 is that the federal government introduced very protective legislation in favor of the corporations and directors and officers with respect to securities litigation. For example, the pleading standards were made stricter. No discovery during the situation until a motion to dismiss is denied, and moreover for forward-looking statements, in other words, projections of future revenue or earnings, for example, were given significant protection. Well, what happened was the plaintiffs are very, at least their counsel, they're very creative, and they want to make a good living, so they meet the challenges that are presented. So they moved to California and generally brought class actions under California securities and common law. The U.S. Congress reacted to that in 1998 and adopted the Securities Litigation Uniform Standards Act, whereby, with certain exceptions, because Delaware had to remain in business, Delaware is basically the king or the queen of corporate law in the United States, is that in class actions involving nationally traded companies like stock exchange companies or NASDAQ stock exchange companies, that class actions could only be brought in federal court under federal law. So that generally means that with respect to the nationally traded companies, only individual actions can be brought. The result is that attorneys have been given a great deal of relief to a large extent because the U.S. Supreme Court has also generally, in most of their decisions, been favorable to defendants in the last 25 years. The key case is a case called Central Bank of Denver. That was decided in 1994, where before that time, every U.S. Court of Appeals, there's 12 U.S. Court of Appeals, they represent different states. For example, the Fifth Circuit, where I am, I think, is Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi, I believe it is. New York, the Second Circuit, many of you know the Second Circuit is like New York, Connecticut, I forget what other states, but New York, Connecticut, and sometimes there are tremendous diversity changes, like the Sixth Circuit is Michigan, Ohio, Kentucky, and Tennessee. So we know that Tennessee, Memphis, Tennessee, is very different from Detroit, Michigan, just the culture. We're talking about the South on one hand and the industrial Midwest on the other. And the Ninth Circuit has never been broken up. It's comprised of, what, about 12 states or so, going from Hawaii to Alaska to California to Montana. I mean, it's really just a tremendous large circuit. In that situation, every single court of appeal held that there was aiding and abetting liability under the main anti-fraud provision, which was Section 10B. Section 10B generally prohibits fraud or manipulation in the purchase or sale of securities. Aiding and abetting, I imagine it's the same every word, there's a primary violation. There's substantial assistance by the aider and abettor, and that's done with general knowledge of the improper conduct that was going on. So aiding and abetting liability. So, for example, a lawyer who would be drafting a disclosure document would be provide, and let's assume there's a primary violation. So the fraudster is engaged in a bunch of lies, and the attorney is drafting the document. Well, there's a primary violation. Drafting the offering document would be deemed to be substantial assistance. And then the case would turn on whether the attorney had general awareness, which most courts held would be reckless conduct, so unreasonable that the actor must have known of the risk, whether there was reckless misconduct with respect to the attorney's actions. And if that were the case, then there would be aider and abettor liability. Well, the Supreme Court in 1994 said there's no aiding and abetting liability under Section 10B, basically overruling the unanimous view of all the U.S. courts of appeals. Well, the result is that attorneys are rarely subject to liability under private securities law today, unless he or she were to offer an opinion letter. When an attorney gives an opinion letter, such as the securities are exempt from registration, then the attorney is making his or her own statement. So therefore is liable for that statement if the requisite fraudulent intent can be shown. Otherwise, the attorney, as made clear by subsequent Supreme Court decisions, the most recent called the Janus Capital decision, decided in 2011, the attorney is not the maker of the statement, it's the client's statement. The attorney is at most an aider and abettor. Now, the SEC has aiding and abetting liability. Congress provided the commission with that, so the commission can sue attorneys and has under the aiding and abetting analysis. But what's happened is that many of the state securities laws, there's not only federal securities laws, there's also securities laws in each and every state that is separate and apart from the federal law, as well as the state common law, they are very expansive. Many of these states are very expansive with respect to attorney liability. So the result is that attorneys are sued under state law and not under federal law in private actions generally, just as a generalization. And moreover, these actions cannot be brought as class actions because they can only be brought in federal court under federal law, and attorneys aren't liable for primary violations. But nonetheless, these cases are proceeding. They're proceeding on a number of grounds. They're proceeding, for example, as individual actions. So what we're seeing are institutional investors, for example. Institutional investors, they're part of the class. They're saying to themselves, we can do better suing ourselves and we will opt out of the class. I gather in the EU system, it is if there is a collective action mechanism, the investors, it's a different setup than in the US, that one has to opt out in the US. And in that situation, the investors, the institutional investors would opt out of the class and then bring...
I don't think there's any opt-out class action procedures in Europe. Opt-in in some cases, but not opt-out, I don't think.
Right, the Netherlands has some, but it's more of a...
Class actions.
Pardon,
sorry? We do that as well.
Opt-out ones or opt-in?
Opt-in, yeah.
Yeah. I can't think of any opt-out though. I know Australia, I know they're not European, Australia are quite advanced, but I think they're opt-in as well. They've got the most American-like model outside America, and even they're opt-in.
Right.
So I think the US are alone, pretty much.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. So what's happening is the institutional investors are opting out and bringing their own actions because they believe they can do better. And then a number of these cases, the companies are insolvent. So there you have a trustee or a receiver appointed, and that trustee or the receiver stands in the shoes of the corporation. So therefore can even bring malpractice actions against the law firms for negligence. And that is happening with frequency. And then under the state securities laws, they are extremely broad. And these state securities laws remedies are being used with regularity, so that the law firms are being sued quite a bit in the private litigation. With respect to the SEC last, let me just talk about client fraud just for a few minutes, and that is going back to the Carter Johnson proceeding. To make this sort of a full circle here, the commission decided not to bring enforcement sanctions against these attorneys. What the commission did was issue what is called a Section 21A report. And the 21A report is a vehicle by which the commission can issue publicly what its position is on an issue and provide notice to the regulated community of setting forth that this is the type of conduct that will result in enforcement action in the future. So that's what the commission did in the Carter Johnson action. And in the Carter Johnson case, the commission said clearly, and by the way, the ethical rules of the various states are very much modeled on this SEC's proposition, although some states go further and some states not go as far, is that the client, all the state ethical rules are this way, the client is the corporation. What happens in these cases is from a critic standpoint, is that the lawyers perceive that the management, that the chief executive officer is the client. And of course, the chief executive officer is not the client. The corporation in the corporate context is the client. So the commission made that clear in the Carter Johnson case. And so many of these cases, even today, they occur because the lawyer gives investment counseling advice, of course not investment advice, I hope, but counseling advice, disclosure advice to the CEO or to the CFO. And these individuals refuse to make the disclosure. They opine, well, the disclosure doesn't have to be made. We don't think that it's important enough to make the disclosure. And, of course, critics would say that the law firm is deriving sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars of fees from these clients, sometimes millions of dollars from particularly these clients. And the lawyer is concerned about losing that engagement. And, of course, whether somebody is at Cravath or White & Case, or whatever law firm may be, that a partner's book of business is huge for one's livelihood. And if one is able to have a client come in with $2 million of fees, £2 million of fees, that'd be quite a lot, even with the with how well the dollar is doing against the pound right now, that's a very significant client, needless to say. And what happened was, and this has happened again and again, is that the lawyers do not go to the board. In other words, they do not go to the independent directors and say, we have this disclosure issue, and we think it must be disclosed. And the fear, of course, that critics say is that if the law firm were to do that, then the CEO would say, well, this engagement is over, and we'll hire another law firm. To do this, and generally the boards, the board of directors, they generally permit the CEO to determine which law firm is going to be retained, as long as it's a reputable law firm. So whether it's White & Case and Cravath, generally the board is fine, so long as it's a well-known law firm. Talking about the major companies, what happened in a lot of these cases is simply the board was not approached in this issue. So in the Carter Johnson case, the SEC said is that you have an obligation to advise the management. And if management refuses to make accurate disclosure, what you can do is once again, nice to meet you.
Thank you very much. I have to rush.
I understand.
Thank you very much.
Okay, I'll finish up in a moment. Is to ask for a second opinion if you so want to, and that's being used very rarely. I think the lawyers are afraid of losing the client if they bring in a second opinion. And to me, that is a vehicle that should be used much more to bring in independent counsel. Or else generally you have to go to the board or a committee of the board that is comprised of independent directors. And once that's done, if disclosure is not made, and if there's clear, if the information must clearly be disclosed, then the lawyer must resign from the engagement. Can no longer take part in the engagement. If the lawyer does, then the lawyer, the law firm, would be an aider and abettor, because it would be knowingly furthering illegal conduct. Now the question is whether the lawyer or the law firm must disclose the improper conduct. Under practically all the state ethical rules, with some exceptions, and the
after resignation, you mean?
Yes, after resignation, whether resignation alone is sufficient.
Mm.
So the law firm resigns, and the question is whether the law firm is obligated to disclose the illegality.
Mm.
Under the most of the rules, it's permissive. It's not required, with one exception, and that is this example: if the lawyer were to draft an offering document, and the deal was being, and when the lawyer drafted the offering document, the lawyer believed the offering document is accurate. While the deal is being sold, the lawyer finds out that the offering document is improper. In other words, there's misleading statements. The lawyer goes to the management, goes to the board, and says, "We need to amend the offering document to correct the disclosure." The board management says, "No, we're selling the deal. It's fine. We're not going to correct it." Well, the rules basically say, the commentary basically says, not the rules themselves, but the commentary basically says, is that in that situation, even if the lawyer resigns, there is a de facto continuation of representation, because the offering document remains alive. And that because of that situation, the lawyer must blow the whistle on his or her client. Now, generally, how this is done today in practice is that if the disclosure, it's called a noisy withdrawal, which in fact it's not really noisy at all. What it is that the attorney would write a letter or an email to a regulator and say, "I have resigned from this representation and disaffirm my work product. I can no longer stand behind my work product," without saying, "Hey, my client is engaged in a fraud." So that's what would be done today if this were to happen. And in most situations, if the lawyer says, "If you don't make this corrective disclosure, then I'm going to have to write the SEC enforcement director and tell that person I've resigned for professional reasons and can no longer stand behind my work product. I must disaffirm it," that generally induces the client to make the proper disclosure.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, today, you know, these cases continue because the lawyers either get co-opted into their client's improper conduct, or they lose their objectivity. That happens quite a bit. That in a lot of these cases, they don't involve junior lawyers. Many of these cases involve attorneys who have been practicing for 40 or more years, who have very successful careers, who for whatever reason either get co-opted into their client's fraud, or they simply lose their objectivity. And unfortunately, in the big firms, I would imagine the same as here, although there's the monitoring, there's a supervision of the associates, the junior lawyers, the senior lawyers basically go about their own way. I'm sure it's the way in Indianapolis. The senior lawyers go their own way, and there's no monitoring, no oversight. So that if the senior partner loses his or her objectivity, there's no one to call that person into account. And the result is that the fraud continues, and then a case follows, either by the SEC, but more normally by private litigants in state court, and there's significant liability exposure. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll be happy to answer any questions, comments.